I next met with Dr. Thomas Stinchcomb, and to begin, he commented on recent research developments in the management of small cell lung cancer.
I think, unfortunately, small cell has been somewhat left behind the advances in non-small cell lung cancer. I think part of that is that a number of the chemotherapy trials, such as amarubicin versus topotecan, didn't show a benefit, and there was some discouragement in the terms of the platinum etoposide versus the platinum irinotecan in terms of improving survival with different chemotherapy platforms. But I think in the last year or two, we've seen some promising signs. I think the development of immunotherapy and non-small cell lung cancer could potentially be extrapolated to small cell lung cancer. These patients smoke, they have a heavy mutational burden, they should be very susceptible to this approach. I think we're also very interested in the Rova-T drug that binds to the DLL and as an antibody drug conjugate. This has shown responses in disease control in second and third line settings. Trial is admittedly very small and preliminary, but it does look very promising.
This antibody drug conjugate, is it specifically been looked in small cell or beyond?
Right now, it's mainly in small cell, but I think they'll expand to other neuroendocrine-based tumors. It targets a DLL3 protein, and some of that is expressed in small cell at a high rate, as well as other neuroendocrine tumors. And consequently, the idea is that the antibody will bind to the small cell and deliver the drug conjugate more effectively. And they've shown some responses in the 40 to 50% range in the second and third line setting.
Well, that's pretty interesting. I guess we already have a couple in practice, you know, brentuximab vedotin in lymphoma, as well as T-DM1 in breast cancer. Same story in terms of delivering chemo, but you don't really see chemo side effects?
They've not seen a lot of the chemo side effects. I think they have reported this rare sort of serositis aspect of that, and I think they're working on a dexamethasone premedication to try and mitigate that side effect, which was unique. A sort of inflammation of the joints and other serosal services.
Interesting. But objective responses have been observed to just the single agent, just the antibody drug conjugate.
Yes. And I'm sure it's going to be explored in combination with chemotherapy at this point.
Well, that's really interesting. So, as you mentioned, it seems like the big thing that almost every cancer you're hearing things about checkpoint inhibitors. What do we know right now about checkpoint inhibitors in small cell?
The data is very preliminary of trials of about 40 to 80. I think the trials that I sort of lean on are there's a trial of Nivo alone and then Nivo-Ipi combination. The response rate to single-agent nivolumab was around 10%, and the combination was around 30%. And then there was a single-agent trial of pembrolizumab. Patients were required to have PD-L1 to go on the pembrolizumab trial and showed a response rate of about 30% as well. I think when you look at these progression-free survival, it's very interesting in that there's a number of patients who have a rapid progression, but about a third of patients have really a prolonged progression-free survival, and the plateau is pretty remarkable, which is encouraging. But then it begs the question is why do about a third of the patients seem to get this dramatic benefit, and can we select those patients based on a biomarker?
I see that you're the PI of an Alliance Foundation trial comparing pembrolizumab to topotecan. That's fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm very enthusiastic. It's a randomized phase 2 trial. Patients will be required to undergo a biopsy prior to enrollment within 42 days. Then it's a 2-to-1 randomization to pembrolizumab or topotecan. And the patients on the pembrolizumab will actually get an on-treatment biopsy 4 to 6 weeks at that time. The idea being that we're going to do a mutational analysis, look at the genomic signature. There's some thought that higher DNA repair damage may be associated with response. Also looking at PD-L1. And we're also going to look at the neoantigen T-cell response because we're collecting peripheral blood. I think another important aspect of this trial is that patients randomized to the topotecan arm will be allowed to cross over to pembrolizumab because I think when you talk to a patient, they maybe get the standard arm. They are disappointed given the tremendous enthusiasm around these drugs, and we wanted to have an opportunity to cross over when we designed the trial.
What's the entry criteria for the study?
You can be relapsed or refractory. You have to have gone through a platinum doublet and have extensive stage disease. And then I think there's a concern about autoimmune diseases and obviously paraneoplastic syndromes with small cell, and that would be an exclusion criteria.
That's interesting. What do we know about, have patients with paraneoplastic syndromes received checkpoint inhibitors either deliberately or inadvertently?
To my knowledge, no one with known paraneoplastic syndromes have received it, but I think conceptually there's a concern that maybe there someone might have a subclinical or occult paraneoplastic syndrome and you may exacerbate that. So I think we're going to be very vigilant on in terms of any immune-related toxicities on the trial.
It sounds like a really attractive trial for a patient to get involved with. I'm wondering, you know, in the discussions about the design, and is this trial actually up and running now?
It's all approved at this point, and I think we're working on the ECRFs or the case report forms and doing some of the logistics that have to go into the trial. I hope to open it in a couple months through the Alliance Foundation.
Right. I'm sure in the discussions about the trial, there must have been discussion about, you mentioned there, I think there's a little data on the combination with the CTLA-4 antibody. Was there a thought about having a third arm that had that combination? What do you think about the combination at this point?
I think the combination's shown obviously tremendous advances in melanoma, and there's an earlier signal within lung cancer. I have a little bit of hesitancy in the second-line small cell about the double combination because of the toxicity, and this still remains a very frail patient population. And so I prefer to do the PD-1, and this will really be a proof of concept. And then if this shows benefit, then we can really go back and look at the double combination, maybe in the upfront setting, because the platinum etoposide is not a perfect therapy.
Certainly, and the correlative science aspect of this is really fascinating. What are you thinking, or what is the group thinking in terms of the potential combination of this kind of strategy with other treatments, chemotherapy, radiation therapy? It seems like this is also something that's been explored a lot in various tumors.
I think there's a number of applications of this. I think there could be a maintenance phase. You could do it in front of in combination with platinum etoposide. I think there's a phase 3 trial of platinum etoposide with ipilimumab ongoing. Then after, for limited stage disease, if this shows activity, that might be a chance to do it after chemo radiation therapy, because we know a lot of patients relapse. We'd have to be concerned about the potential for treatment-related pneumonitis, which has been seen with single-agent immunotherapies. And obviously, patients getting chemo radiation, there's a rate of radiation pneumonitis. But they're all promising areas of investigation.
You hear people talking about synergy. I've heard people in renal cell speculate that maybe patients do better after a TKI for some reason. I've heard, you know, in MDS, they've talked, we were doing a thing the other day and they were talking about hypomethylating agents, but, you know, increasing PD-1 staining. It'll be interesting to see in your topotecan arm what happens to PD-1. What do we know about the effect of chemotherapy? Does it upregulate it or change it?
We don't know at this point, and I think the trial will investigate what the response rate is, which will be effectively third line, and maybe the response rates will be similar at this point. And we're going to try and collect as much tissue as possible to really dive deep into some of these questions of mechanism of action.
Let's go through some of your cases, beginning with your 62-year-old man.
So this was a very pleasant 62-year-old gentleman. He was diagnosed with squamous cell non-small cell lung cancer. It was stage 4 by intrapulmonary metastasis on the contralateral lung. He got treated with CARB, NAB, paclitaxel, and the community. Did very well on that for 4 cycles, had a response, and then subsequently had disease progression.
Could I just ask you before you go on to pick up on that point? So you mentioned that he had been treated, I guess, prior to getting to you with this combination. And it's interesting in terms of initial first-line therapy for metastatic squamous cell in this country because, you know, we're constantly surveying people to try to figure out what they're doing. And we consistently see like a split between carbopaclitaxel, carbonab, and carbogem. I'm curious what you yourself, how you approach it. Is that what you would have treated him with, or would you treat him with something else?
So I think that's a reasonable opportunity, and my practice patterns follow your split. I think that all of them are valid selections. I think CARB-NAB paclitaxel has been associated with a higher response rate. So if I have a patient who's very symptomatic, maybe with central disease, airway compression, and I think I really need to get a response and a relatively rapid response, I think that that's my preferred option. I think that also the carboplatinum and the weekly NAB paclitaxel schedule requires more visits. Sometimes it's a little bit gentler on maybe the elderly or the frail patient. And those are the two situations that I kind of move it to the forefront of my selections.
Do you think we have, you know, solid evidence to say one way or the other? Because I hear people with their viewpoints, but I'm not sure exactly about the data about the relative neurotoxicity of NAB versus paclitaxel and based on, you know, schedule.
I think that's the challenge of the trial was carboplatinum day 1 and NAB paclitaxel weekly versus carboplatinum paclitaxel every 3 weeks. So you've essentially changed both the schedule and the formulation. I think you can say on that schedule that there's a lower rate of sensory neuropathy, lower rate of grade 3 sensory neuropathy. and a low rate of arthralgias, myalgias, but they were very low. And then the weekly schedule gets you more anemia and thrombocytopenia. I think one thing that's sometimes forgotten about that classic phase 3 trial is that you're able to extend the platinum taxane combination beyond 4 cycles. And if you look at the taxane fact taxane scores, after cycle 4 on both arms, the taxane toxicity scores go up. I think one of the things when you're trying to minimize sensory neuropathy, you've got to be very cautious going beyond 4 cycles, because I think that's when you run into the most of your problems. And this can be a very debilitating toxicity or very aggravating toxicity for patients, you know.
Any thoughts about the secondary issues with NAB versus paclitaxel in terms of shorter infusion time and the lack of need for corticosteroids and the lack of allergic reaction in lung cancer? Do these play out at all as being important or not really?
I don't think the pre-medication is a big advantage at this point. The shorter infusion time does help rather than the classic 3-hour infusion time. But the flip side is that you have to come back weekly, and that sometimes for some patients that's not a barrier, but other patients it can be an inconvenience, especially if they come from like an hour away in our area, and family members have to take them and other issues. And I think what you're seeing in your survey, and I think among many people, is that most of us use all three, and it just depends on the specific patient in front of us.
Right. So this patient got the carbo-NAB. You say he had a response. How did he tolerate therapy? And was he symptomatic from the disease when he started treatment?
Not really symptomatic. And he was doing very well. And he was still golfing. He was a very active 62-year-old gentleman. And he got a good response and did very well. He didn't have any problems with sensory neuropathy or any other issues at that point.
And so he was just progressing by imaging?
Correct.
And what happened next?
Then at that point, I think, like you've talked about, the enthusiasm for immunotherapy, his doctor recommended that he come and investigate a clinical trial for immunotherapy. And he was able to enroll on a trial of a PD-1 inhibitor. And he tolerated this remarkably well. And he actually had stable disease for about 6 months. I think classically we always think of immunotherapies as response, non-response, but there is a group of patients that seem to have a disease stability for a period of time.
And then what happened?
Then at that time he progressed radiologically and a slight increase in the cough. And so then the question became, what we previously thought of as second line therapy is now our third line therapies. And so...
Before you get into that, just to sort of backtrack a little bit in terms of what happened to him and what's happening to other patients in your practice, at this point, in general, are your patients with metastatic squamous cell sort of just gliding right into an anti-PD-1 therapy second line?
Yeah, I would say my squamous and non-squamous patients are going to the PD-1 inhibitors as a second line almost universally, unless there's a contraindication.
And this has been Nivo, Pembro, or both?
Predominantly Nivo, in part because we participate in some of the trials. And also, I think the Nivo, there's no need for the PD-L1 testing at this point. And so that just makes it a little bit more convenient.
Certainly, that's the answer we're hearing from a lot of people. I'm kind of curious, though, when you think about Nivo and Pembro, at least those two drugs, certainly we have a lot of data on them. In your mind, do you see any way to distinguish them? And is the clinical issue really just the FDA approval not requiring PD-L1 testing? Why you end up using Nivo? In your mind, do you feel like they're sort of equivalent or maybe not really?
I think they're pretty equivalent in terms of the toxicity and in terms of the efficacy compared to docetaxel. And I think you can make some minor Pembro's every 3 weeks versus every 2 weeks, other minor issues in my mind. But I don't think in the efficacy you're going to differentiate them right now.
I'm just curious. And again, I find myself asking this question in so many different settings nowadays. Are you persuaded enough by the little data we've seen in small cell with checkpoint inhibitors to think about it outside a trial setting? Again, putting cost reimbursement aside, you have a patient who says, I'll pay for it, who doesn't have any other options. Do you think it's a rational thought at this point or just too early?
I think it's a rational thought. I think the small cell is a little bit more challenging because I think topotecan on the sort of the daily for 5 days, every 3 weeks is a hard drug to tolerate in terms of the anemia, thrombocytopenia, patient convenience. If I had an extensive stage small cell patient who progressed on platinum etoposide, I would definitely explore that based on the preliminary data, in large part due to the fact that topotecan's not very user-friendly or patient-friendly.
In terms of toxicity, again, if somebody were to say, you know, what's the likelihood that I'm going to have a serious problem that's going to, you know, need some attention?
I generally say about 1 in 10 patients have serious problems, and then I really focus in on the hepatitis, the pneumonitis, and the colitis, and say that that happens about 1%, and really emphasize that if you have diarrhea or you have problems breathing, you need to call us, and we're going to get you in. And then I generally tell them about how we use high-dose steroids to kind of treat the toxicity, and that something that you have to be vigilant about and aware of, but we do have effective treatments for that toxicity.
Just one other question I have to ask you, particularly because you're actually doing a trial, and I'm curious what you're doing in that study, but also clinically, how do you deal with the issue of people with pre-existing autoimmune disease? What kind of disease will, you know, something like, you know, thyroiditis versus, you know, Crohn's disease versus multiple sclerosis?
So I think some of the patients with hypothyroid or thyroiditis, we feel more comfortable treating. I generally try and get the endocrinologist involved just so that they're aware that there might be a change in the thyroid management given this new drug. I don't have the confidence to treat the patients with inflammatory bowel disease or Crohn's disease. I think that that is just beyond my comfort level right now.
Yeah, it's difficult too when you have people who don't have many other alternatives. So this man, unfortunately, we're all excited about checkpoint inhibitors, but unfortunately, even though he had a period of stability, then had disease progression. Now, at the point that he was progressing, how symptomatic was he from the disease?
He wasn't that symptomatic because he was on trial. We were getting regular CT scans, and so we were able to catch this before he had symptomatic progression.
Just sort of looking at the decision at this point, certainly a very, very common decision. In your mind, how would you sort of analyze the evidence-based options?
So I think when I look at these patients, the first question is, are they a chemotherapy candidate? And if they are, I generally will go with a chemotherapy platform. I think we know from patients who are EGFR wild type, the trials of comparing docetaxel to erlotinib showed a higher response rate, progression-free survival, and overall survival with those getting chemotherapy. And so then once I've decided they're a chemotherapy candidate, I think the primary options are docetaxel or docetaxel and ramucirumab that come to mind.
And can you talk about the data and what you generally do and what you did with him?
Yeah, so I think some of the things, there was a phase 3 trial that compared docetaxel to docetaxel, ramucirumab, that had a statistically significant higher response rate, longer progression-free survival, and overall survival. There were not the classic angiogenesis toxicities such as hypertension and hemorrhage associated with this. There was a higher rate of neutropenia and a slightly higher rate of febrile neutropenia. And so I think the patients who are candidates for the docetaxel every 3-week schedule, which are the more robust, good performance status patients, I have a discussion about both docetaxel and the ramucirumab combination with docetaxel.
What happened with this man? What did you end up doing?
We discussed and he initiated treatment with docetaxel and ramucirumab. And at that point, he elected to go back to the community because it was a 2-hour commute and we had a discussion and he can get this at home. And then I followed him sort of at that point, and he did very well on the docetaxel ramucirumab for 4 or 6 cycles. And that was the most recent follow-up I've had. He's still doing well. There's no significant toxicities.
What would you be thinking about if he did develop disease progression? And you mentioned, you know, you referred to the issue of EGFR TKIs. And there was a study presented, I think, last year that kind of was surprising, looking at afatinib versus erlotinib. What about the choice of afatinib in a patient like this?
So I think that that's a very intriguing study. I think the culture has gone towards more EGFR TKIs and EGFR mutant patients. And I think there's been somewhat the assumption that these are all interchangeable. But in that trial, afatinib versus erlotinib, there was a higher response rate with afatinib, 6% versus 3%. And then after that, there was a longer progression-free survival as well as overall survival. I think that this is a challenging situation because there are not a lot of fourth-line squamous patients out there, and that's essentially where the clinical space for this. I think the trial did show a benefit. I have to confess that my preference is generally to try and get these people on clinical trials, perhaps even do a biopsy and see if we can match a molecular marker to a clinical trial in this patient population. Because either way, both arms had a relatively modest response rate in progression-free survival, and I think we can do better.
Going back to the issue of the ramucirumab, I guess one of the things about that study that was interesting was it was squamous and non-squamous. And I guess the squamous, they didn't see the kind of problems that was seen with bevacizumab. Right now, are you thinking about this or the way you thought in this man with both squamous and non-squamous?
I'm thinking about it as a sort of a histology agnostic aspect of that. About 25% of the patients enrolled were squamous, and there was no signal of increased toxicity at that point.
Why don't we go on to your next patient, the 56-year-old man?
This was a 56-year-old gentleman who was treated with chemo radiotherapy, carboplatin paclitaxel, for stage 3 disease, did very well. And then, like many of our patients treated with chemo radiotherapy, about 9 or 12 months afterwards had progression. He presented with increasing cough and some dyspnea on exertion, which necessitated a CT scan. And that showed when you look at the CT scan, some increased mediastinal lymphadenopathy, some bronchial narrowing. And there was concern that he might have had impending upper lobe collapse at this point.
What were you thinking at that point in terms of treatment options?
So at that point, I referred him to our radiation oncologist, and he wasn't a candidate for any further radiation therapy, they felt, or they felt it wasn't going to add much value. And so then my options fell back to the squamous options at this point were carboplatin paclitaxel, carboplatin gemcitabine, and carboplatin nab-paclitaxel. I elected to go with the carboplatin nab-paclitaxel based on the response rate, which was about 45% in that trial. Because this is a man who's symptomatic, and if he even has local disease progression, he's going to get much more symptomatic, and I was concerned his performance status would go down. He wouldn't be a candidate for further therapy, so I thought I better take my best shot up front, and I chose the combination with the highest response rate.
And what happened?
He responded quite well, got 2 cycles, had some response, and then got 2 additional cycles, and same appearance at that point, and then was doing quite well this time.
What about toxicity?
He did have some mild neuropathy that was there, and then he did develop some anemia that didn't require transfusion, but we had to observe the anemia at this point.
I'm sorry, can you clarify which treatment exactly did he get?
He got the carboplatin AUC of 6 and the nab-paclitaxel on a weekly basis.
What about necitumumab in this situation? What is the data there, and do you ever use it?
So this patient came in actually before the approval of necitumumab. I think that that is now a treatment option for our patients with metastatic squamous cell. The combination that was studied with cisplatin and gemcitabine with and without necitumumab showed a statistically significant improvement in survival and progression-free survival and a similar response rate. The response rates were about 30% in both arms. So I think that this is an option, and I think that's the first drug that's been shown to reveal a survival improvement in the squamous patients above the platinum-based doublets at this point.
And have you used necitumumab yourself?
So, very interesting. I think that I would like to use the necitumumab. I think when I do use it, it will be with the cisplatin gemcitabine backbone. I actually submitted it to our P&T committee, and they put it on hold, and I think it might reflect a changing impression of oncology drugs and more questioning of the price and the relative value.
I want to ask you, switch back and talk a little bit about some of the, again, research that you're involved with that I think is really interesting. I want to begin with a study that I think really caught my attention, the randomized phase 2 of erlotinib alone or combined with bevacizumab. There's been a lot of discussion about that strategy that I've heard in the last couple of years since a paper was presented and published out of ASCO. Can you kind of talk about the background to that study and what's going on with the study?
So the background goes back to several years ago, the beta trial, which was in the second line setting, compared erlotinib to erlotinib bevacizumab, and was a trial that showed an improvement in progression-free survival, but no overall survival. But they had 30 patients who they had confirmed EGFR mutation, and there was a trend towards an improvement in progression-free survival and overall survival in this small subgroup. And I think that was the clinical basis. And if you go to the preclinical data, there's some evidence that the EGFR TKI and the VEGF inhibition can prevent primary resistance or more effectively treat acquired resistance. And so this combination was taken forward. Actually, our trial was launched at the same, in the U.S., was launched at the same time as the Japanese trial, and we met with the Japanese investigators, and so we have a very similar design, just so that we could potentially combine the data. The Japanese trial showed a robust improvement in progression-free survival. The combination showed a median progression-free survival of 16 months, and the erlotinib alone had a median survival of about 9.7 months. The hazard ratio was 0.54. I think, interestingly, the benefits seem to be more pronounced in the exon 19 patients than the exon 21. And so I think that was very promising data. In addition, there's the Swiss trial by the ETOP group that was a single-arm trial that showed the erlotinib bevacizumab had a median progression-free survival of about 14.4 months. And I think that these two are longer than what we see with single-agent EGFR TKIs in most of the trials. Our trial is currently accruing. We've accrued 74 out of 86. We project the trial to complete accrual in July of this year. And then we'll have to follow the patients for the progression-free survival events. I think the advantage of our trial is it's a randomized phase 2 trial, so it'll be another comparative trial.
Any comments about the biology of this? I remember when the Japanese trial was presented, John Haymock, I ran into him, and he's like, yeah, you know, the VEGF's upregulated in EGFR and et cetera. Do you buy into that?
Yeah, he's published one of the papers on that. And I think they follow patients in the cell line models, and the patients with EGFR mutation who subsequently develop a resistance, there's a corresponding upregulation of the VEGF expression. So the thought is that this might be one of the escape mechanisms for EGFR TKIs. And having the bevacizumab would suppress that escape mechanism. And he's used studies with primary as well as secondary resistance that have sort of validated that the combination of erlotinib, bevacizumab, or venetinib, which is an older drug, worked better than single agent erlotinib or gefitinib. So the preclinical data is pretty strong. And I think I would argue that the clinical data is following the preclinical data right now.
I think it's kind of interesting. I don't really see too many people sort of jumping on this bandwagon outside a trial setting. There are a few people, like Mark Chris loves to push people's button by saying this is his usual first-line therapy. Everybody gets all, their blood pressure jumps up for that. But what about using this strategy? I'm sure you want to get everybody in your study, but if they're not eligible, what about using this strategy up front? And another strategy I've heard is adding in Bev in a patient who's slowly progressing after response to erlotinib. Either one of those things you do outside a trial setting.
So I don't do any of the erlotinib bevacizumab off trial, but I'm well aware many people do because that's actually a competitor to the trial enrollment is that some people can do this successfully off trial. And I don't think that's unreasonable. You do have randomized phase 2 data in the single-arm Swiss trial, and so I think that's not unreasonable. I think when you look at the toxicity, there is a higher rate of hypertension, proteinuria. And then I don't know the economics, the ease that you can get this approved. The one challenge on or off trial is that we've taken this group of patients that had been taking a pill, doing very well, leading normal lives, and now we're obligating them to coming in to get an IV infusion every 3 weeks. And I think that sometimes can be a deterrent to this either on or off trial, this combination.
Let's talk a little bit about mesothelioma and where we are today with that. We did see some data on that at the last ASCO meeting. Maybe we can get into this by talking about your 67-year-old lady.
So this was a 67-year-old woman who was actually very healthy. She was walking 3 miles a day and subsequently noticed some increased dyspnea and exertion, a slight cough. Then she went to her primary care physician and got a chest x-ray which showed a pleural effusion. This led to a thoracentesis, and the diagnosis came back as suspicious for mesothelioma. And she was taken for a VATS to confirm the diagnosis. Then on the CT scan, she had some increased mediastinal lymph nodes, and they were lit up on PET scan, which was done. So we underwent a biopsy of the mediastinal lymph nodes. She was evaluated by thoracic surgery and determined not to be a candidate for extrapleural pneumonectomy. And so then she was seen by me for systemic therapies.
Just to backtrack a little bit, what was her occupational history and did she have risk factors?
No risk factors for asbestos, no known asbestos exposure. And she actually worked as an artist, and so there's no industrial exposure that I could think of.
That's interesting. What fraction of mesothelioma patients have no history?
I would say in my practice, off the top of my head, I would say about a third of patients, you can't really pin down the asbestos exposure. So the classic shipyard worker, as we all learned in medical school, they're not as common as what we thought in medical school.
Before we get into what you did, you mentioned that she was felt not to be a candidate for extrapleural pneumonectomy. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the way you evaluate patients initially and what the procedures are that you consider?
Well, I think we want to do a really diligent staging, and that's why I think I've used the PET scan more to make sure that there's not extra thoracic disease. There can also sometimes be some peritoneal studying in the mesothelioma patient population. And so that's sort of the first non-invasive test. Then I think when we look at the extrapleural pneumonectomy, we want to set the bar high to make sure that we're really benefiting these patients. So you have to look at their cardiopulmonary function, making sure that they don't have congestive heart failure. And then we look at the histology to make sure they're not a sarcomoid mesothelioma, which is a relative contraindication. And then if they have mediastinal lymph node involvement, we've generally not taken those patients for extrapleural pneumonectomy under the premise that you're not going to get complete resection at this point. And I think we evaluate a lot of patients for this, but the number of patients that actually go to it, at least at our center, is very small.
What's the post-op morbidity?
I think the post-op morbidity can be pulmonary hypertension, congestive heart failure, increased dyspnea on exertion. And so it is a big operation in terms of the patient, in terms of the quality of life and the recovery period.
So this patient then came to you. What were the options you thought about and what did you do?
So I thought about carboplatin pemetrexed, cisplatin pemetrexed, and then cisplatin pemetrexed based on the recent phase 3 trial that you mentioned at ASCO.
Can you talk about what we know about those three options in terms of data?
Sure. I think cisplatin pemetrexed was sort of the FDA-approved label showing an improvement in survival compared to cisplatin. And then they did an expanded access, and they found that in this big expanded access program that carboplatin pemetrexed had similar efficacy to cisplatin pemetrexed. So I used carboplatin and pemetrexed without hesitation in my older, frailer patients or maybe the symptomatic patients who I think are going to struggle with handling the cisplatin, nausea, vomiting, and fluids. I feel that that's an option. And then I think this woman was unique in how functional she was and how asymptomatic she was at this point. So I talked to her about the cisplatin, pemetrexed, bevacizumab, which we're very familiar with from our lung cancer experience in terms of the toxicity and just the familiarity with it. And that this did show a survival benefit over cisplatin and pemetrexed of about 3 months, hazard ratio 0.77, as well as a progression-free survival. And given her high performance status, no comorbidities, and a desire to be treated aggressively as possible and as reasonable, that's what I recommended to her.
What happened?
She was just initiated on the cisplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab at this point. She elected to go home to get the treatment closer to home, which is a recurring theme. She's from South Carolina and saw me as a second opinion. I talked to the referring oncologist, and we gave him the Lancet publication because I think there's always a concern about off-label use, but I think this data is pretty convincing for this patient population.
How do you generally approach the issue of maintenance in these patients? You know, you mentioned the different regimens, including this one. What do you do in terms of maintenance? What do we know about maintenance?
So I think in the trial of cisplatin, pemetrexed, bevacizumab, the patients got 6 cycles, and they could continue on single-agent bevacizumab maintenance as part of the initial therapy. I think we also have phase 2 data of platinum pemetrexed and continuing maintenance pemetrexed. It was a single-arm trial. We know the patients who got the maintenance pemetrexed did better, but you don't know if that's a difference in prognosis versus the actual therapy. And within the CLGB, there's actually a randomized phase 2 trial looking at people who got platinum pemetrexed and randomized them to pemetrexed or observation that will hopefully evaluate the role of pemetrexed maintenance in mesothelioma. I do use it when I have a patient who gets through 4 cycles of platinum pemetrexed and they're doing very well. I think in mesothelioma, it's a little bit different in that we don't really have an FDA-approved second-line therapy. So if you have a patient doing well, you don't want to risk progression and symptomatic progression, and there's not a good plan B.
In terms of second-line, as always, we can start talking about checkpoint inhibitors in mesothelioma. It kind of seems like there'd be a big mutational load. I don't know whether there is or not, in fact, when you study it. But what do we know about mesothelioma in terms of PD-L1 staining and also checkpoint inhibitors?
I think, like you said, Neil, intuitively, we think that this would be a great disease. And given the absence of second-line options, I think that we really need to sort of pursue this. I think there's a phase 3 trial that's going to get started in Europe, really looking at pembrolizumab in the second-line setting, is what I heard. And I think we really need that data because there are these patients out there, and we do see them, and there's a limited number of therapies at this point.
This concludes our program, and we should note that subsequent to recording this discussion, the FDA Oncology Drugs Advisory Committee voted on April 12th to wait for the results of the ongoing Phase 3 randomized controlled trial of rosalitinib in non-small cell lung cancer before making a decision on approval of the drug. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Lung Cancer Update.